What is the relationship between your personal practice of Yangsheng, nurturing life, and your clinical efficacy? Is it important or even relevant for a practitioner of Chinese medicine to embody the ideas of Yangsheng? In other words, can you be a good healer of others if you can't take care of yourself? Are the short lifespans of many historical and contemporary Chinese medicine practitioners due to their failure to practice self-care? Or could it be related to the wounded healer pattern? In other words, to the fact that they started out with and were inspired by their own frail bodies. Considering occupational hazards from a different angle, how do you meet a depleted patient without depleting yourself? What does a healthy or ideal interaction between the patient's qi and the practitioner's qi look like? Does the practitioner replenish the patient's qi? Or is it a question of merely attuning the patient's body, like tuning a piano instead of playing it, and leaving it up to the patient to replenish their own qi? I'm your host, Dr. Sabine Wilms, and I'm joined, as usual, by Leo Locke, resident purveyor of multiple perspectives at the Pebble in the Cosmic Pond podcast, where we share old and new stories about China's healing traditions and about medicine in heaven and on earth and in the sweet spot in between. For this episode on occupational hazards in Chinese medicine, we invited our dear friend Michael Max to join us. As the host of his famous Theological podcast and a practitioner with decades of experience, he was the perfect conversation partner. Before we get into the conversation, I'd like to remind you to sign up for my newsletter at happygoatproductions.com/connect to stay in touch. Also, please rate, review, and share this podcast wherever you can. Lastly, are you tired of waiting until the next new moon for the next episode to drop? And do you want to join us for the second half of this conversation on the juicy topic of dealing with Bing Qi while avoiding martyrdom? And do you want to support my work through a financial contribution? In that case, I invite you to join my Imperial Tutor Mentorship, where you can listen each month to the exclusive follow-up Imperial Tutorial episodes that drop on every full moon, in addition to receiving all sorts of other benefits, like weekly translations and live tea time talks on Zoom. Find out more and sign up at happygoatproductions.com/imperialtutor. And now let's get into the conversation. Thank you. Okay, so hi, Leo and Michael.
Hello. Hey, Sabina.
Yeah, hey, thank you for joining us, Michael, dear friend. Leo and I had a conversation last week about, I think it was about dietetics, and somehow we got talking about aging. I'm trying to reconstruct how we ended up at a place where we wanted to, and we both thought about Michael Max and decided you are the perfect person to invite and have a conversation about Leo, this was your expression, the occupational hazards. We were talking about my bad back, the effect of the computer work on my health, how it's my Ming, my destiny to spend so much time on the computer and do this translation work, and how it's really hard on my body. And then we got talking about how a lot of medical practitioners actually throughout history in China did not grow very old. So that's where the occupational hazard conversation came in. And we both decided, Michael, you would be the perfect person to talk about this for two reasons. The first one is that you have interviewed countless Chinese medicine practitioners over the years in your Cheerlogical podcast. I mean, you're just, you are this, you are prop, you, I bet you know more about the, you have interviewed more Chinese medicine practitioners than anybody else, maybe in the world, because you've been doing it for so many years. You probably have a better sense of where people are at. And you have interviewed a lot of elders, which is, I think, is a great service that you've done. Plus, your own style, you are also, like us, kind of a perfectionist. I know you love your podcast, and I know it's your passion project, and you and I have had some conversations about how we both have to be careful about not burning out, because you work super, super hard, and you do that in addition to your busy clinical practice. So you have your experience of interviewing people, you have your personal experience of being a experienced practitioner with, I don't know how many decades, of a very busy clinical practice, and your podcast, your experience with working really hard on your podcast. And then I also get the sense that you're really interested in Yangsheng and dietetics and that sort of bigger picture of what Chinese medicine can be beyond treating illness towards longevity, towards improving health, that Yangsheng aspect. It's a topic that I think you're interested in your practice. And I don't know, Leo, you want to add to this?
I would like Max to start, because I can't wait to hear his insight.
Okay. First of all, I might disappoint you guys.
No.
I'm serious. So I've talked to a lot of practitioners. It's true. I haven't talked to them about this in particular. Okay. I mean, the whole idea that there's like, occupational hazards in Chinese medicine, actually in any work, we don't think about that so much. It's a great topic.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing to consider. I'm going to come back and tell you a story about it in a moment. But first, like Yangsheng diet and all that. Look, there's a lot of other people who are doing a lot with Yangsheng and pay a lot of attention to it. I'm not any kind of expert, and I would say I'm kind of a lousy practitioner of Yangsheng. I meditate on a pretty regular basis. That's very helpful. I need my 21 minutes a day of not arguing with the world. Very useful. You know, but in terms of like movement and exercise, I fail a lot. Except in the summer when it's a little nicer to be outside. There's all kinds of places where I just do not tick the marks that I probably should. So there's that. There's a part of me that also looks at it and goes, you know, life is short. I could spend some time doing this thing that's is supposed to improve my life, or I could be enjoying my life. All right, so there's really that balance aspect too, of like what I'm supposed to do, and like what brings me joy, what brings me connection, what brings me, you know, a sense of ooh, life is yummy, right? So often we're talking about, you know, the work we have to do, and there is that. How often do we talk about making life yummy?
I'm sorry. This morning I woke up and I make my little task list. And on my task list was the same item as on my what I'm excited about list, my imaginary. And both of them said, I get to have a podcast conversation with Leo Locke and Michael Max. So for the next hour, we can hit both of those at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we can claim that this is work.
Well, it's like work and the best, I was going to say work is play. That's not true. But like good work, when you run into problems with it, it's not like, oh, it's hard, poor me. You run into problems with good work and it's like, ooh, how do I work this one through? Right? There's there's some juice, there's some excitement, right? There's that sense of, oh, I'm going to learn, buckle up. We're going to learn something here. Like, roll up your sleeves. Could take some time. But
yeah.
That, you know, and if you have that in you, then work is, I guess, a kind of cultivation in a mm-hmm. sense.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. anyway, that's where I'm at on Yangsheng.
If I may.
Yes.
Offer an interesting observation, because I think in the profession of Chinese medicine, there seems to be this idea that the practitioner, the clinician, is also the Yangsheng expert. There seems to be this expectation that the practitioner should embody the highest principles of Yangsheng. You know, like the person who does the Yangsheng well is the clinician. That seems to, I don't know if this is your impression, but that's definitely my impression. But in reality, that's not the case. Both in the West and in China and in the Sinosphere, a lot of the times, the brilliant clinician sometimes is the worst young representative for Yangsheng. So there is the Yangsheng jia, you know, the Yangsheng mm-hmm. expert, and there mm-hmm. is the brilliant technician clinician. And the two oftentimes cannot be found in the same person. That's what I've observed.
Yeah. I'm with you. Wasn't Ye Tian Shi like famous for drinking and playing cards as well?
I don't know. But I do know that according to, you know, we have this Jingfang tradition nowadays. And then this one famous Jingfang master from the 70s and 80s, Liu Duzhou.
Oh, yeah,
everybody have a Liu Duzhou. Liu Duzhou had many students. And when I was reading through the lecture notes of one of his famous students, Hao Wanshan, Professor Hao Wanshan from Beijing, he did mention very clearly that Liu Duzhou was obese. And he often had challenges with phlegm. So he has to mm-hmm. take certain formulas to take care of his phlegm. And that was a clear admission from his student. But Liu Duzhou yes. is one of the masters, the top masters mm-hmm. of Jingfang. Almost everybody knows who Liu Duzhou is. But he is nowhere, if it's according to his student, the best example for Yangsheng. And I'm mm-hmm. going to give another very famous example, Liu Lihong. Liu Lihong, everybody knows, right? Dr. Liu Lihong. Who is Liu Lihong's teacher?
Liu Duzhou?
No, Li Yangbo. Very few people heard about it, and less so people have. Liu Lihong actually wrote a book about his teacher, Li Yangbo. He was one of the most brilliant physicians of his time. And when did he pass away? I think in his 40s.
Okay, but here's something, Leo. I have a question. It could be, I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, your implication may be that people, Chinese medicine practitioners, die young because they're not good at Yangsheng, or they may not be good at, or they may just not specialize in Yangsheng. But what I've also seen a lot is that the really brilliant practitioners, including some of my friends, they became brilliant practitioners because they have frail bodies. There is a connection yes. between people, or they're very psychic, so they're very connected to the other realm, but they're so ethereal that
yeah. So
they're too much in heaven and not enough on earth, or the other way around.
There's a word, in the specific domain, they have a term, technical term for that, called the wounded healers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's an archetype.
Yeah,
actually.
Wounded healers.
Yeah. And I would go so far as to say that anyone who's working in the healing trade, there's a wound in there somewhere.
Yeah. Well, that's where we want to hear from you, Michael, since you have interviewed so many, you know. Neither Sabina have I have so as much exposure to the variety and the...
Yeah, but I haven't talked to people about that.
Oh, really?
You're the first people I'm talking to about this.
Oh, we're kind of honored.
Well, you're the one who invited me here.
Come up with weird questions, Leo. You know?
I mean, maybe going forward, I can ask these kinds of questions and explore this. It's not a bad idea. In fact, it's a great inquiry. Mm-hmm. But for sure, many of us are in this trade because of some problems we've had.
Yeah.
And even if we haven't, look, all humans have some kind of wounding. That's just called life on you know, the dirt ball. And we're often drawn to some kind of healing or medical or helping type trade because of that wound. In part, we're trying to help ourselves.
Because this is so important, because this just came out on Facebook in the last 24 hours. Because I hear this a lot.
Wounded
this
healer?
Type of argument and statement that says, how can he be a good doctor? He couldn't even take care of himself.
Yeah, that kind learning of argument.
Right. Yeah. This is a recurring theme I've heard and noticed over the years. Unless you are an embodiment of this Yang Sheng principles and this poster boy of everything flowing, then you have no business, and we shouldn't trust you in your clinical abilities.
I would not trust the person who looks perfect.
Yeah.
I'm going to trust the person who's been down working in the weeds.
But, you know? But it's interesting. Yeah. This is a theme that I've seen occurring over and over again, right? I don't know how...
Hold on, Leo. Among Chinese medicine practitioners or in general?
Yes. Okay. People making those remarks and say, how can you study with this person? He didn't even live past whatever, or he doesn't even exhibit all these traits.
Yeah,
but
right.
The overarching theme is that he does not embody the ideals of Yang Sheng. How then could he be a physician?
Because he's not teaching Yang Sheng. He's being a physician.
Yeah. In some people's mind, in some of our colleagues or the students' mind, those two things are one.
Right. We have a fetish about the ideal practitioner, the master, who's old, by the way, right? They're always old.
Yeah.
Some of them are.
So I wonder how widespread is this notion? That's what I'm curious. I've heard it before from certain people. Mm-hmm. But in your impression, in what you have witnessed over the decades,
yes,
is this a widespread notion, or is it something that's only limited to a select few?
I don't know, because I haven't thought about that. I haven't been looking. But as we're having the conversation here, Leo, I think what you might be talking about is a developmental issue or developmental perspective. So if you're young or if you're new, you know, students, that kind of thing, or new practitioners, or just a young person, maybe haven't had enough experience yet to realize that, you know, it's in some ways, it's the troubles that you run into that make you into the kind of practitioner that you are. And the idealism that I think many of us have at the beginning, clinical practice will wear that away from you over time. So are these people that are suggesting we should be perfect embodiments of Yang Sheng, are they young? Are you getting this from people that are above the age of 50?
I haven't really looked into that aspect of who...
Just a hypothesis.
Yeah, something I'll pay more attention to from now on.
Yeah.
Right, because when it comes to like religious people, like when I'm just thinking, if I want to find a wise person for myself, if I'm looking for wise counsel, I would want somebody who's kind of been through the ringer, who the universe has sent through what I call the spin cycle in the washing machine. Because every time I've gone through that spin cycle, every time I have gone through a divorce, lost a farm, had a major physical or spiritual or whatever kind of thing happened to me that's made me grow and transform. So I would be the opposite, Leo. Like, this is so interesting.
Yeah.
Well, there's something I can tell you in my own experience, having been at it for a bit. I think early on, I was hoping that if I learned the medicine and learned it well, if I practiced it well, it would give me a bypass on some of the suffering in life. Nope. We're still going to get sick and die, even though we're Chinese medicine practitioners. We're still going to have issues with our relationships. Any issues that we might have with things like finance or status or power or authority, you know, all the things that trouble a human being, you don't get a bypass on it by being a good practitioner. So one of the occupational hazards is a bunch of stuff that we carry around that's maybe not really true, or any kind of stuff that's shadowy that we'd rather not pay attention to. It doesn't go away. In fact, it's if you're going to be a practitioner for any length of time, have the capacity to sit with other people, a lot of this stuff is going to come up. Mm-hmm. You're going to go through some spin cycles because you need to. It's development.
Yeah. And so, isn't that interesting? It kind of resonates with me with our earlier conversation on meditation-induced sickness. It's almost the same idea, right? Like people got into meditation thinking that they can bypass a lot of their issues and challenges, but in fact, it was brought up in even more intensity.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think it's called spiritual bypass, right? In some circles, that's what...
I've heard that term.
That term.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's going to come back and bite you.
if we're not paying attention, yes, it will.
Yeah. Sabina has a puzzled look on her face.
I always do.
Are you thinking about something? So what about
Let's hear from Sabina. Let's hear about that puzzlement.
No, I just had this thought that I would not go. I'm so picky with who I go to see as a medical provider. I'm a very sensitive person. And, you know, I'm not a doctor, so I don't dispense medical care. I'm and thinking about this as the recipient of medical care, it would be my worst nightmare to have a doctor with the perfect body, because a doctor with the perfect body is not... I mean, they might be just enlightened. They might just be those individuals do exist. But to me, like, I used to have really horrible insomnia. Nobody can grasp the agony of having insomnia unless they've been there. Unless you are a really like Leo, unless you are like a living on the way to becoming a living bodhisattva, and then you just can be there with people suffering in a way that most of us can't. But otherwise, like my friends, and you know, I'm a menopausal woman, so I have a fair number of friends who are suffering from insomnia, and I think it's kind of going around these days. And those of us who have insomnia or have had periods of insomnia, I can just see my friends who have a tendency to that. I can see when they're in that space, and I'm extra careful with them, and I lower my voice, and I don't give them long lists of things to do, and I know to be really supportive and gentle, and because they're not in a normal state. And so it would be my worst nightmare to go to a doctor who is like super like you know, super healthy and buff and loud and gives me this long list of, oh my God, you didn't do your half an hour of Qigong this morning and eat your three eggs and what, you didn't exercise this week? Like, you know where I'm going here. So I'm having a hard time understanding why somebody would be attracted to a... But maybe that's... The difference is that I'm thinking about your observation, Leo, from a patient's perspective as opposed to a Chinese medicine practitioner looking for a guru-type person.
I think that exists as well. Don't you think, Max?
I'm sorry, say that again?
I think what Sabina was trying to say is this seems to be a phenomenon that is more perhaps prevalent amongst patients who are looking for perfect practitioners rather than practitioners looking for teachers and gurus. But
I think it depends on what a patient's looking for. Sometimes they're looking for someone like that buff doctor who's going to tell them what to do. Maybe they're looking for that. They're looking for someone to hold them accountable, or that's just the way they roll. So they want to game up, and they want a doctor to tell them what to do.
And there's practitioners that are happy
to dispense advice.
Hmm. Yeah.
But I think the trick to being at least a Chinese medicine practitioner is to meet our patients where and how they are. Because if they're really depleted, we need to, like you were saying, you need to support them. And if someone's got a lot of chi and they're like, go, 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 and show me how to do it, well, you can, you know, boo that stuff up.
Yeah. I think that's the difference in terms of perspective from a clinician such as Michael, who has to see a lot of different types of patients versus coming from more like a patient point of view, right? Yeah. So I want to talk about something like an occupational hazard, which is in Chinese we call 病气.
病气.
Yeah, the disease, the qi of the disease or pathogenic qi. Because we come in contact with, you know, if we have a general practice, most of us do, you know, a primary care kind of practice, then we comes into contact with all kinds of folks with all kinds of health issues.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have skin problems. Some people have, upper respiratory infections. Some people, you know, all kinds of problems. And in Chinese medicine, we say they carry different types of 病气.
Mm-hmm.
So when we come into contact with those, this variety of pathogenic qi, that is an occupational hazard.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
Especially if you take it on.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about does one take it on and how does one not take it on? Is it simply a choice of the practitioner, or, you know? That's where I think it's kind of fun to explore a little bit.
Is it a choice of the practitioner? It might have to do with, I don't want to say cultivation, because that's going to take us down a different avenue. I would say it has some to do with the experience of the practitioner. Because in time, you learn how not to do that. Let me give you an example. All right, this is something that took me a while to learn. Finally learned it. Man, I'm a slow study sometimes. There were days I would come home from clinic and I was exhausted. I mean, I was just wiped out. And one of the things I found is that there would sometimes be patients, and they're like 20% there. You know, it's my job to help them, but they're like 20% there. And I would bring up some extra qi to bridge that gap so I could meet them and there'd be 100% of energy. I got news for you. Not great for the practitioner. and not great for the healing relationship either. Because if someone, I don't know why people might show up with 20% of the energy that they could be showing up with. Maybe they don't really want to be there. Maybe there's other stuff going on. I don't know. But I do know this. If I show up with more energy than they do, I'm going to suffer. So if they show up with 20%, I'm going to show up with a little bit more. I'm going to show up with 25%. It's not because I don't care about them. It's because that matches the resonant sort of flux that's in the room, where they are, what's going on. When I show up with 80% to their 20, they're going to be overwhelmed. Or I'm just doing the work for them. It's not my job to do the work for them. It's my job to help them do the work themselves with needles, with herbs, maybe some advice if they ask for it. But one of the ways that you can injure your chi is by putting so much into your patients. Y'all know what I'm talking about.
Can you be a little bit more specific about that? Because, like, exactly, like, what specifically can a practitioner does that belongs to that category?
So maybe I'm having a hard time getting information from them.
Uh-huh.
Because they just go off on tangents or they just don't say much. And I'm trying to dig out what's going on for them. And sometimes they're not forthcoming.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm fine. I got a general idea, including there's this thing that's in the way. I'll just put them on the table and feel their pulse and tongue and check their abdomen. Come up with the best that I got in that moment, where they are.
So then what is the example of what not to do? And so instead of that, what
So instead of that, you spend an extra 20 minutes. Now you're running late. You know, because you're really trying to be helpful to this person.
Like,
got to make sure you get it right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm.
I don't know. Does that help?
Yeah.
Is it still a little too amorphous?
That was an interesting take, Michael. Like, that took me by surprise. And I don't know if that was your response, Leo.
How were you surprised?
Not really, because if I were to use a language from another circle or another domain of knowledge, people would call that vampirism. Because there is this notion that the patient might be acting as an energetic vampire.
Mm-hmm.
Is using this evasiveness as a way to draw energy from somebody else. So there is that notion among certain circles of practitioners or people in other domains of, you know, practice that will talk about that. They will use that archetype of vampirism. The person is so conditioned and used to using this evasiveness to draw energy towards them. By sometimes it's not that they're intentionally doing that on purpose. They're actually unconscious of it. They just know that if they behave in that way, they seem to be able to feel better.
And I think we all know that from interpersonal relationships. We all know people like that. So on a gut level, that's, you know, whether you're talking about a neighbor or a friend. And as I get older, I've learned I have to be really protective. What struck me about Michael, about this direction, is your way, like, I'm not a practitioner, right? So this is me being stupid. I would think that
stupid. If you weren't stupid, what would you be?
Ignorant of
the
world of you guys as professionally practicing doctors. I want to say that I would have, the way you started that, your story, I would think that most patients come to you less than 100%, and you come to you see a Chinese medicine doctor because you're not 100%. So mm-hmm. I was thinking the kind of the opposite, where, oh, the poor person, they're only at 20% of where they should
be.
No,
I need to put all this extra energy into them. Here's what I have to say to that.
Isn't it your job to give them the other 80% with your needles and your herbs and dietary advice and whatever you do? Isn't that what you do in clinic?
I agree. It is over time. Ibu ibu lai. Step by step.
Yeah.
And Leo's point is well taken. I'm a little uncomfortable with that idea of vampire. It's just that word makes me a little nervous. But the dynamic that you described, that's exactly spot on. It's not conscious. It's just a way that folks are used to being with other people. And part of my job as a practitioner is to be with them in a different way and help them revitalize their energy system in a way so they don't have to do that.
That is self-sustainable.
So it's self-sustainable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But how do you revitalize their system for them to get there?
Well, it depends on what's going on. Are they damp? Are they blood deficient? Are they qi deficient?
But isn't that what you do in clinic? You treat them with your qi. Like,
No. I do not treat them with my qi.
Yeah. That's a fascinating topic.
Okay.
Yeah, please continue, Max.
Yeah, I don't treat them with my qi. Listen to me. I feel really emphatic about this.
Yes.
I don't treat them with my qi. I'm not doing any fa qi kind of thing. I don't do that. It's not my job.
Yeah.
My job is to help them with needles, food, herbs, maybe lifestyle, maybe the way the relationship is structured.
Yeah. So that's fascinating to me, listening to both of you, right? Sabina, you seem to have this notion that when a Chinese medical practitioner treats a patient, he or she would put qi into the patient. Is that, am I capturing that accurately about what you just said?
I know I would be dead meat as a Chinese, as a clinical practitioner. I'm not a clinical practitioner because I wouldn't last a day. And I come from a family of doctors, and I know what price Chinese medicine practitioners pay for what you guys do. And I think it's absolutely essential that we're having this conversation. And I think it's one of those things that students don't learn enough in most institutions about how to protect themselves.
You learn it in practice. I don't think you learn it in school.
Yeah. So a lot of students, I see that was my experience at where I was teaching. I was really interested in following up with the students and seeing how few of them actually managed to become successful Chinese medicine practitioners, and how quite a few of them either dropped out or were unable to sustain a clinical practice in a healthy way for them. And that was always one of my concerns, is like, what are we doing as teachers? There's something missing. There's a piece missing that we're not teaching. And maybe it's not something that you can teach. I don't know. So there's that.
I think
and
you
then
can
the
point
other
people
thing is,
toward it.
What's that?
I think you can point people toward it, but I'm sorry I interrupted. Continue, and we'll circle back.
Well, and the other thing is, when I'm thinking about what I do with my goats, because I treat my goats. I don't work on humans, but I do feel like when I had my goat who had, when I rescued my goat who had horrible mastitis and she was on her way to be put down, she was incredibly malnourished and had two babies who basically had sucked the lifeblood out of her. And I do feel like I spent hours three times a day massaging her and just touching her and just holding her. And, you know, I remember when my daughter is sick, I hold her hand, what I do, but I'm not a practitioner. Maybe that's the difference between a professional practitioner. And I know about the power of healing touch. Isn't that what healing touch, or when I think about Brenda Hood, when she used to give me tuning fork treatments or whatever treatments she used to give me, and the treatments that I have gotten, there is an interaction between chi and chi, between my chi and the healer's chi.
Yes, there is an interaction. I agree there's an interaction. And I would go so far as to say there needs to be some kind of commensurate exchange of chi. If it's always chi going in one direction, it's really bad for the practitioner. And it's not helpful for the patient either, because all vital relationships in nature are based on exchange.
But that's why they pay you, I would think.
Right?
But that's why you pay the doctor.
Well, it's in part why you pay the doctor. But sometimes what we're working with patients is on this more energetic level. And it's about being able to relate in a way that demonstrates exchange. Sometimes people come in, they don't relate very well to other people. I'm not here to be their psychotherapist, but there's a, I hate that word energetic, but it's the closest I can get at the moment. Leo, you may have a better word. There's got to be a sense of exchange, vital exchange. I'm not saying that we get something from our patients because, you know, it's our job to help them, but there's got to be this healthy, vital, two-way encounter, or it's not helpful for either person.
How would you frame it, Leo?
I have a different angle to look at it or think about it. Because what I see is, it seems like, Sabina, you have the idea, please correct me if I'm mischaracterizing what you're saying, like a treatment is a pouring of energy from one person to another. My own sort of sense of it, perhaps Michael's as well, is I look at it more as an attunement, like a mechanic, right? Or like a piano a tuner. Mm-hmm. You don't go in there. You're fixing the piano, not in the sense that you're taking it apart or you're adding any new pieces to it. You just go in there and, oh, this part is too loose and that part is too tight. You just balance it. But you're not playing the piano. There is a pianist that will eventually play the piano. And the beautiful melody and music that comes out of it is not of your making. Mm-hmm. I'm the tuner. I just tune the instrument so the pianist will play it herself. It's her instrument. It's her responsibility and her magic to play the song or the melody. It's not my input. I don't input into that melody. I tune the instrument to such a place that she plays it herself.
That was perfect.
Yeah, so that's kind of my sense
of what tiao is. In Chinese medicine, we say tiao qi, tiao xue, tiao shen, tiao xin. In our culture, it's all about tiao. Tiao is a tuning, is an attunement. It's not a, I'm going to interfere and I'm going to give you this boost of energy from my end to yours, and I'm going to push and I'm going to give you a transfusion of my divine energy. Right? So,
sweet.
So, right? We use tiao qi.
Yeah.
Right?
So the tiao li, right?
Yeah, tiao.
Same tiao, tiao li.
The Chinese culture is all around tiao.
Yeah.
I'm not playing God here. I'm just there like the, you know, the fine tuner. Oh, this little bits. We say 四两拨千斤, right? The 4 ounces or 4 liang of effort to move the 1,000, jin of things. It's the fulcrum. What do you call that effect?
Like a lever.
Mm-hmm. That is, to me, the highest state of Chinese culture and Chinese medicine. It's in Tai Chi, Quan, right? In the boxing of Tai Chi, we go into the strategic point and then we gently apply something and the entire system shifts. To me, that is the highest embodiment of our ideal. The Chinese ideal is that. The sage practitioner or the sage who knows where to apply the minimal effort for maximum effect.
Mm-hmm.
That's our culture. That's the truest form of the Chinese ideal. And we see that in many of our pre-modern or near-modern master practitioners who has in China, who had to see hundreds of patients a day, sometimes 100, sometimes 150. Right? We talked about that. They just took the pulse and they wrote the prescription. How would they have time if they would be pouring their energy and life force into every single patient? They would be done by the 10th one. How could they see 150 a day? So that's kind of my perspective. And also, I think some of it actually stemmed from, okay, I'm going to get in trouble again.
Okay.
Because I'm not going to talk about another translation issue.
Because we like the thorny topics, right? That's part of what we love about our podcast.
Yeah.
And that's our goal, is to find the sweet spot in between. This is your opinion, or this is one perspective. This is the other perspective. Let's find the place where the rubber hits the road, whatever the word is. We like to pursue the kind of sticky points where we disagree.
Yeah.
Because those are our favorite places to learn from each other. So go for it, Leo.
Because this is going to hit really, really deep. Because this is a very deep, least deep-seated misconception or mistranslation that exists in our field. So that is the phrase, Yi zhe yi ye. Because a lot of times it is translated as, you know, medicine is about your intention. So that means I'm not trying to offend anybody or trying to put anybody down, because yi zhe yi ye a lot of times is being proposed as this is our axiom of using the needle. You put the needle in and you put your intention into the needles and you want the needles to do this and do that. Well, where does yi zhe yi ye came from, our first instance of yi zhe yi ye? A lot of times we don't go back to the original source. Yi zhe yi ye came from, I believe, Hou Han Shu, right?
I don't know.
It is the Hou Han Shu where they talk about the biography of one of the doctors, a Han Dynasty doctors, who was treating the royalties. And if we go back and look at the context of the first instance of Yi Zhe Yi Ye, He was not talking about intention. He was saying, you know, I was not able to treat the royalty accurately because once I know of their status, I became overwhelmed. I became scared. I was, like this is a princess or this is a marquis. If I do something wrong, I'm going to lose my head. They're going to chop my head off. But if you disguise this royalty as a maid and let me take her pulse, because I don't have the preconceived notion of who or she is, then I don't have that fear in my heart. Then I can diagnose the person accurately. Therefore, he says, 医者医也, meaning don't disturb me. Don't emotionally disturb me when I'm diagnosing. My emotional calmness is of the utmost importance when I'm diagnosing a patient. It has nothing to do with putting your intention into the needles onto the point. Maybe this is a valid way of doing acupuncture. I'm not saying that. But if we go into the first instance of the occurrence of that phrase, that doesn't really mean that. And then, of course, Sun Si Miao Yi also says, 医者医也, and then some Ming Dynasty. And if you look at each of those instances, they mean something different. Yeah. They frame, they use, everybody say 医者医也, but they don't mean the same thing. That's another thing that seems like our colleagues are not aware of, is a lot of phrasing in Chinese medicine and other terminologies go through semantic shifts. Everybody's using the same word or the same phrase because they honor the ancestors.
But and it's really tricky when, like, I've been hired to translate modern Chinese medical historians' articles that are just full of these quotations. And in modern Chinese articles, they just, the authors, the historians get away with it because they'll just quote this, they'll just quote it. They don't have to translate it. But then if you translate an article into English, you can't just cite the classical Chinese, but you have to actually translate it. So the process of quoting an ancient text is completely different from having to translate it. So when we translate a modern Chinese book or article, like when I did Liu Lihong's book, for example, there was so many quotations in there. And you know, it's so easy in Chinese. You just quote these passages from the Neijing and you move on. And everybody just assumes you kind of know what you're talking about. But then when you do this work, when you translate it into English, it's not just the modern Chinese you're translating. Yeah. You're also having to translate the classical Chinese. And I was trying to figure out, how did Liu Lihong use that phrase from the Han Dynasty when Liu Lihong is a modern doctor? And how do I translate it? Do I translate it in the Han Dynasty sense, or do I translate it in Liu Lihong's sense? Or is he maybe quoting his teacher, who was a Taoist philosopher? That phrase, it just gets used by so many people in so many different ways, for sure.
Yeah, because if we pay attention to how a word, a term, a phrase got propagated throughout the centuries and the millennium, we see that the Chinese authors are prone to quote, but if you really read them in context, they usually change the meaning of it because they want to
and
appear
same with Chinese
to be honoring
philosophy.
The ancestors.
I mean, it's same with when
I don't
they,
know about
when
Chinese
quote,
philosophy.
Oh, yeah, when they quote Confucius. They're like, Confucius said this or that. And I'm like, when you actually look at the original source, it's so... Or even look at how Confucius quoted the Shijing. you know, Confucius interpreting these ancient poems where it's a boy and a girl like flirting across the river, and you know, the supposedly it's all about fertility when there's talk about fish nets or whatever, certain species of birds being sighted and whatever. And Confucius interpreted it as it meaning virtuous cultivation of this is just part of the history in China. People have always done that, where they've ruthlessly taken a line out of context and used it for their own purposes.
Because such is the perspective of an experienced translator such as yourself, Sabina. But I don't think that is the perspective of many of our listeners and, you know, colleagues out there. When they see something in Chinese, that's it. That's what it means. And they are very firmly bind to that notion, because this is the truth. This is what I learned from my teacher. That's what it means.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or it's just what I want to believe.
Oh, yeah.
So this is one of the great I want to say dangers. For me, it's a danger. I don't know about other people. For me, it's a danger that there's something in Chinese that I don't really understand, but I kind of make it fit with how I think things work here and now. And I go, "Ooh, look, the old Chinese, they said the same thing." But it's like I'm putting words in the mouth of, you know, putting words in their mouth, because I don't quite understand it. And
I get this all the time with my students.
You know,
they want something, and they're so excited when they think they figured out what something means, and they're like, "This is such a cool thing!" And then I'm like, oh, "Sorry, it can't mean that. It doesn't. The grammar doesn't work. I'm sorry."
Yes. And they're like, "Oh." I can totally relate to that excitement.
Yeah.
Because I did the same thing with Sanskrit. When I first started learning Sanskrit on my own and Bali on my own, I was so sure that I found this thing, you know, I had this insight, you know, and I was like, I know this is exactly what it means. But having this experience with Chinese medicine and translation, from that point of view, I know the tendency to make this type of mistakes. So I was conscious enough to ask somebody else who was way more advanced than I. And he was like, "No, grammatically, that just doesn't make sense. This is not how Sanskrit grammar works." I was so disappointed that what I thought, the epiphany I had, actually was a fantasy of my own. But having this other experience in another dimension, I can totally see that's exactly what happens to people in Chinese medicine. And I know that very well. So I can borrow the experience and say, "Okay, Leo, you're doing the exact thing that you warn people about in the other language. So don't do it." Right? Listen to people who are way more advanced, and you know, so.
Yeah, Michael, do you have any more modern examples of this, or can you relate this back to the occupational hazard thing somehow?
Oh my goodness! I feel like we need cigars and a bottle of whiskey, because we can go for another 3 hours on this.
Maybe we can.
I'm trying to get us back to the root. The origin of this whole conversation.
Yeah, the occupational hazards. I would say this. They're out there, and often we're not aware of them until we're in the middle of some kind of kerfuffle with them. And this is part of what goes into becoming a practitioner. You know, we're going to have ideas about what's the right thing to do. And they're great ideas, but they're ideas. They're, you know, it's a hypothesis, and we test it out in our clinical work and see if it actually holds water. Sometimes it does. Great. Sometimes it doesn't. Oh, great. Square one again. And then you feel like an idiot. And then you wonder if you know anything. And then you wonder if you're ever going to be able to like really learn this and make a go of it. But that's just part of the iteration that you go through. It's the spin cycles, as you put it, Sabina, that you have to go through.
But you know what?
To become seasoned as a practitioner.
It's a spiral, right? Where you go from
periods where
you...
It's a spiral, but it'll still make you dizzy and make you want to barf.
Yeah. But there are periods where you think you've like really grasped something, and then you're like, some more advanced person will tell you, oh, you got the grammar wrong. Sorry, you can't see that. And you're like, oh, I don't know anything. But then you're starting to the process. You're like, oh, but it could actually mean something way, way, way deeper and way, way better than your original understanding, which you got attached to. So maybe it's all about like...
100%. I just want to say, I completely agree with you about a spiral. I absolutely agree with you. And it's essential to recognize that you're on a spiral, because it doesn't feel like you're on a spiral. It feels like you're on a circle and you're just going in circles and like, oh, great, this again. And if you can recognize some bit of knowledge or experience that you've harvested from the last time around, or, oh, I'm in one of these again. What is there here for me to learn? I can recognize the spiral that I'm on. I think that's really helpful because it feels like failure. I think it's important to realize that these moments do not feel like triumph. Maybe on occasion they do, but mostly they feel like failure.
But those are actually where you learn, and that's what facilitates the next step up. Just like your Leo, your example of learning Sanskrit, where when your teacher tells you, no, grammatically, you can't do that, you're like really crushed. But at the same time, you're learning an important grammar lesson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And know that infatuation does not equal sometimes knowledge, true knowledge, you know?
Oh, what
one
do
can
you
become
mean?
Infatuated.
Oh, man. I just love this medicine. Yeah.
We all do, though. It's what keeps us going.
Yeah. Yeah. It's easy to be infatuated.
It's part of the occupational
hazard. Leo, thanks for
hazard.
The warning.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of our podcast. If you enjoyed this conversation, here are a couple of suggestions for learning more. First, remember to subscribe to my newsletter at happygoatproductions.com/connect to stay in touch. I do strive to offer a healthy balance of free and paid information there. Also, if you liked this episode, please rate, review, and share our podcast. And join the conversation on our Pebble in a Cosmic Pond Facebook group, if you feel like it. And then, if you can't wait until the next new moon for the next episode to drop, why don't you join my Imperial Tutor Mentorship to listen to the exclusive Imperial Tutorial follow-up episodes that drop every full moon? In addition, you also receive a cultural and historical introduction to each month and 3 original translations by me of a classical, a medieval, and a surprise text on Chinese medicine spaced a week apart, often related directly to what we're talking about in the podcast. And you get to join my live tea time talks. Find out more about the cultural roots of your medicine at happygoatproductions.com/imperialtutor. And now, go out there and spread some positive vibrations between heaven and earth.